Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Charleston for the first Small Wonder event of the day. I'm absolutely delighted to be welcoming Nikki Segnit, our speaker this afternoon. Very rarely for Charleston, we actually have, as you see, tasting things in front of you. I think the secret is not to eat anything now. Is that right, Nikki? Yeah, until you're actually told that you can, that you're given instructions. Just to give a bit of background to Nikki, Nikki worked in advertising until 2004, when she at last had time to ponder what had for her become the big question in life. How do you go from being good at recreating meals from recipes to creating something original and delicious of your own? There was, she decided, a missing link, a kind of thesaurus of flavors. And the result, after much work and experimentation, was the Flavor Thesaurus, a compendium of short and pithy stories revolving around 99 characters and their liaisons. As you can see from this copy, and the copy that she has, and the copies at the bookstore at the back, it's one of the most beautifully packaged and covetable and ultimately indispensable books that you could imagine. And aside from being an extremely entertaining read, will immeasurably improve your cooking. And fortunately, you have the chance to buy them here afterwards. Please join me in welcoming Nikki Segnit. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you to Charleston Small Wonder Festival for inviting me. What a start. Thank you very much. My name is Nikki Segnit, and last year my first book was published. It's called The Flavor Thesaurus, and it's a compendium of flavor combinations, and I'm going to start by reading you a couple of entries from it. Juniper and olive. Flying is tough on the body. After a lot of twiglets, a handful of olives, a Bloody Mary, a very small sandwich, two boxes of crunchy snacks of no known national provenance, a glass of champagne, a suspiciously smooth pâté with bread roll, a glass of red, a salad of explosively tough cherry tomatoes, a beef bourguignon whose accompaniment of boiled carrots and mashed potato serves only to emphasize the meat's weird insubstantiality, as if it came from the ghost of a cow. Another glass of red, a horrible chocolate mousse, a Bailey's, a Doll's House selection of crackers with silicon cheese, a port, nice, two coffees, not, a snack pack of Jaffa cakes, a three-quarter flight selection of sandwich slices, a truly disgraceful cup of tea, a scone with raspberry jam and cream, and, to depop the ears on descent, a Fox's glacier fruit gun misshapen at the bottom of my handbag. I often feel a little brackish arriving at JFK Kennedy Airport. No better cure for this than a dirty martini. They're like regular martinis, except with the brine from the olive jar added. The murky, salty oiliness of the brine brings the gin's aromatics alive. And boy, do they give you an appetite. Coriander leaf and lime. The first time I ordered Vietnamese and beef and coriander noodle soup, a wedge of lime turned up in it. I put it to one side and left it there, grinning at me as it leaked tangy beef stock into my paper napkin. Lime, I thought, is sweet. Bear in mind, I was brought up on Rose's lime cordial and its matching alien plasma marmalade, sweet and then some. The more I ate Vietnamese and Thai food, however, the more lime began to turn up in savory dishes, most often in partnership with coriander. It wasn't long before I was ordering dishes simply because they came with lime and coriander, which is a bit like buying a song because you like the backing vocals. Coriander and lime are the woo-woos in Sympathy for the Devil, completely and utterly indispensable. I'm just going to give you a little bit of background on how the book came about. So, like many people who enjoy cooking, I started to be interested in these kind of strange combinations, so things like chocolate and chili, strawberry and balsamic vinegar, and then the kind of strange things that Heston Blumenthal was putting together in his kitchen in the Fat Duck, so things like oysters with passion fruit. I'd also actually just recently taken a wine course and had been intrigued to learn the difference between taste and flavour. Forgive me if this is teaching some of you to suck eggs, but flavour is mainly detected by our sense of smell, whereas taste is really strictly limited to the five qualities that are detected by the taste buds that are on your tongue and scattered elsewhere. Across your mouth. If you pinch your nose tightly, You can tell whether something, you can tell what taste something is. You can taste saltiness or sweetness, but you can't tell what flavour it is. And so I thought we would do a little tasting exercise just to remind ourselves of this. And what I'd like you to do in a moment is to take the strawberry in one hand and then use your other hand to pinch your nose quite tightly. And then, still holding your nose, bite the strawberry. And once you've given it a good chew, then unpinch it. And when you do that, all the flavour compounds from the strawberry will flood up to the nasal passages up the back of your mouth. So, do you want to have a do that? Let's do it. Pinch, take a bite, and then give it a good chew. And you should be able to detect on your tongue some sweetness and certainly some sourness. And then unpinch. And that's the difference between what you're doing with taste and flavour. So, in fact, actually, it's one of those things that we know really subconsciously about this when we have a cold. So we have a cold and we have a nice dinner date. It's completely ruined by not being able to experience the flavours in our food. But of course, if you think about drinking a lemon sip, you can really experience the horrible bitterness that you have in the paracetamol, and you can taste the very strong sweetness that's been put in there by the manufacturer to try and cover up that bitterness. But when your cold is really, really bad, you shouldn't be able, even you won't be able to tell whether it's a lemon lem sip or a blackcurrant lem sip, because the flavour part, your nose, your olfactory bulb in your nose is so swollen up by the cold, by all that blowing, then it just completely blocks the ability of the flavour compounds to get to the place where they then send the signal to your brain about what something's flavour is actually like. You can actually fight this if you have a nice dinner date when you have a really bad cold. And I'm not saying that necessarily you should abuse over-the-counter medicines, but you can take ibuprofen, and sometimes that will actually de-swell the olfactory bulb enough just so that some of those flavours can get through. You didn't hear it here. So my interest duly piqued, I decided to buy a book about flavour combinations, but it turned out that there wasn't one. Not in this country, there's nothing in the States, there's nothing in the stacks of the British Library. So with the blithe innocence of the amateur, I thought I might compile it myself. The name, The Flavour Thesaurus, popped into my head soon after, and the book is pretty much as I originally conceived it. It follows the form of Roget's thesaurus. The back section lists alphabetically 99 ingredients or flavours, and then suggests classic and less well-known matches for each. And then the front section contains an entry, a sort of paragraph of varying length for every match that's listed in the back section. So just as the front section of Roget then is organised into philosophical themes, rather than just alphabetically, the front of my thesaurus is organised into flavour themes. So there are things like bramble and hedge, green and grassy, and earthy. And then all the flavours are arranged into their flavour families in a spectrum around a wheel. I'd be able to have a look at this closer up when you have the book in your hand. But the wheel is then published here. And when I say a spectrum, it is a spectrum. Pretty much all the flavours have something in common with each other, so they sort of run into each other. So, for example, goat's cheese, which is in the cheesy family, runs into lamb, which is in the meaty family, because they share a fatty acid, which gives them a very kind of common flavour characteristic. And cardamom in the citrusy family runs into rosemary in the bramble and hedge family, because they both have a very, very strong amount of something called eucalyptol as part of their flavour. And in fact, if you have a pot of cardamoms at home and you give them a really big sniff from the bottle, you'll see just how like Vicks Sinex it is. It's very, very similar. It's only by cooking that we kind of dampen down that rather slight, I mean, almost too much like Olbass oil for cooking purposes. So you go on and on around the wheel, really, and you can enter at lemon and maybe, you know, find yourself lost until you come out at blue cheese. You might think that a food book is quite an odd fit for a short story festival, but the Flavour Thesaurus is an unusual food book. It's made up of 982 short or shortish paragraphs containing one flavour family, one flavour combination each, and they draw promiscuously on flavour science, history, culture, chef's wisdom, my personal prejudice, and anything else that might shed light on where or how flavours might work together. The idea isn't so much to tell a cook what to do, but it's really to provide a spark for their own ideas, to get you in the mood for cooking, really. And just as a good short story often turns on a single event, perception, or a feeling, many of the entries in the flavour thesaurus rely on a single, sharp, evocative perception of a flavour or a combination of flavours that I've experienced. As anyone pretending to have read Proust will tell you, flavour is a repository of feeling and memory. Just as smell is said to be the most redolent sense, so the flavour of a certain combination or a dish can transport us back instantaneously to the time and place that we first experienced it or experienced it at its most memorable. And here are five combinations which take me back to my youth. Chocolate and coconut. Just as government health departments warn that using marijuana can lead to harder drugs, so sweet tobacco led to my addiction to cigarettes. You could, with rice paper, make a rolly out of the strands of cocoa-flavoured coconut. Don't let's ask for the moon, I puffed at the dog. From there, it was only a few fake hacking coughs to the truly rank taste of real fags. Crikey, I thought as I inhaled my first. These are terrible. If, as I've been led to believe, the cigarette companies were so dastardly, why didn't they learn something from the confectionery companies and make their products irresistible? I soon learnt that they had, but it had nothing to do with the taste. Years later, I was back on the confectionery again, this time in the form of fancy chocolate with notes of tobacco and smoke. If you're looking for a hit, try Praeliss's Tanzani, tobacco, treacle, raisin, or the Vanuatu, smoke, spice, licorice. Vanilla and raspberry. Around the age of six, I was always badgering my mother to buy Arctic Roll. I loved the ship-in-the-bottle impossibility of a cylinder of raspberry jam-encircled ice cream enclosed in vanilla sponge, seemingly without a seam. How had Birdseye done it? Was it a section of a single vast Arctic Roll, the length of the Trans-Ural pipeline, piped full of ice cream by forces of unimaginable scale? And how come you could defrost it without the ice cream leaking out or the sponge turning soggy? These days, I like to tell myself I've outgrown my taste for elaborate confections in favour of very simple, very expensive ingredients, simply prepared. Fresh raspberries, say, their violet-scented elegance enhanced by a little chantilly cream prepared with icing sugar and vanilla extract and nothing else. And then my husband took me to La Cuisine de Jules Robichon in Covent Garden, and I ordered le souk for dessert. Le souk is an iridescent, semi-transparent Christmas bauble of sugar, inflated in much the same way as a glass blower breathes sphericality into brandy balloons. Filled with mascarpone and raspberry mousse and steadied on a plate by a ring of pink meringue flecked with gold leaf, on a coulis of mixed berries sprinkled with pistachio dust, and next to a perfect quenelle of vanilla ice cream. And I thought sod simplicity as I shattered the bauble with the back of my spoon. This is how to eat. Blackcurrant and aniseed. In the days before the drinks industry thought of sugaring hard booze with cordial and flogging it to teenagers, we had to do the hard work ourselves. We added lime to lager, orange to gin, lemonade to port, and blackcurrant to absolutely everything. Lager in black, cider in black, Guinness in black, bitter in black. We would have added it to white wine, as we'd heard the French did in Kir, and to red in the less famous Communard or Cardinal, which is not such an off-putting idea when you think about the blackcurrant notes in Cabernet Sauvignon or Pinot Noir. If you wanted blackcurrant, but wine wasn't sold much in pubs back in those days. If you wanted blackcurrant in something daintier than beer, you ordered a Pernod in black, which tasted like those blackcurrant sweets you sucked until the fruity coating cracked and, a little disturbingly, as in a dream of broken teeth, gave access to a soft, slightly salty licorice centre. I really live this combination by pairing a tangy blackcurrant sorbet with pastis ice cream. I go on to give the recipes for those. I'm not going to read them out. You'll be glad to hear. Now, a rather peculiar study has been made about the correlation of menthol sensitivity and reading. Sensitivity to the cooling sensation of mint is associated with an increased tendency to visualise scenes in books vividly, to hear conversations of the characters, and to feel textures and temperature and wind, even if these scenes are not described in great detail. But the higher a person's sensitivity to the taste of peppermint and to menthol in particular, the less likely he or she is to enjoy reading fiction. I assume it's just too visceral an experience. So you'll find a delightful after eight on your plate so that you can see just how sensitive to menthol that you are. And you can check my flavour and fragrance descriptions here. I did want to give you an envelope so that you'd be able to turn it in 90 degrees to see what I was talking about when I talk about the figure eight and how if you turn it through 90 degrees, it becomes the sign for infinity. But I see that they don't actually put that on the, rather unhelpfully, they don't put that on the envelope. Mint and chocolate. Oh, and please do eat along. Mint and chocolate. Hell is a milk chocolate mint crisp, the kind whose flecks of mouthwash-flavoured grit the manufacturers hope will be too drunk after dinner to spit back into the foil. Fudgy saccharine milk chocolate meets sinus-widening menthol. I've had more appetising things collect in my dishwasher filter. Mint, with bitter dark chocolate on the other hand, you can feed me till my teeth ache. It was around Christmas 1978 that I realised the potency of the After Eight mint as a symbol of infinity. First, it was always after eight, if you thought about it. Second, there was a subtle, if not occult, clue embedded in the name, after eight. After infinity. What came after infinity? Nothing. Exactly. Then there was the wafer-thin mint itself. First, the delicate snap of dark chocolate, bitter as plum skin. Then soft fondant, so sweet your ears start straining back until the peppermint invades your nasal passages like an inhalation. Not so much refreshing your palate as dry cleaning it and leaving you fidgety for your next hit of chocolate before you've tongued the last trace of fondant from the roof of your mouth. All seemed powerful arguments for never stopping eating. And then the packaging smells so good. The crisp foil of a Bendix chocolate mint isn't a patch on the After Eight's musky black envelope. I could imagine tearing them open like those fold-out samples you get in magazines and smearing a hint of Roundtree's number eight behind each ear. Do you have a smell of the envelope? I do think it's one of the world's most beautiful smells as an After Eight's envelope. When it came to the entry on whitefish and potato, I couldn't in all consciousness not write about fish and chips. But the history of fish and chips is well documented. It's also not very interesting. So I thought that what might be more useful is a mini guide for the foreign visitor, ill-equipped to avoid the kind of bogus fish and chips that might put them off for life. Fish and chips. Some pointers for anyone seeking an authentic fish and chips experience. One, fish and chips is not necessarily fish and chips. To qualify as the real thing, it has to come from a chippy. This is not only for sentimental reasons, to achieve the essential softness of the chip and to cook enough pieces of battered fish at one time to stop them losing heat or going soggy. You need the sort of hardcore double frying equipment rarely found outside the dedicated chip shop. Two, a chippy serves fish and chips, mushy peas, fish cakes, saveloys, battered sausages and pickles, at a stretch, pucker meat pies. Avoid opportunistic fish bars that offer burgers, fried chicken, kebabs or pizza. Three, salt and malt vinegar are essential. Other types of vinegar are not acceptable. Four, the fish and chips must be served in proper chip shop paper, which to the uninitiated looks, feels and most importantly smells like newsless newspaper, and is the secret ingredient in proper chip shop fish and chips. It seasons them. If they're served in polystyrene boxes, eat elsewhere. Five, fish and chips must be eaten in appropriate surroundings. To be truly authentic, you should be eating your fish and chips by the seaside or at a bus stop or perched on the wall outside a petrol station, breathing steam into your hand because you couldn't wait for the chips to cool down. Highly useful, I think. Now, I mentioned earlier how a flavour of food is particularly apt at taking us back to circumstances in which we first experienced it. And it's perhaps no accident that those circumstances are often at a remove from the familiar. So when we're on holiday, for example, when we're liable to be trying new dishes or trying something that's been cooked maybe as it should be, or just because we're so relaxed that we're actually kind of noticing what we're eating and having time to contemplate it and enjoy it. And the next few entries are surrounding those kind of experiences. Oyster and chili. My first oyster was pressed on me by a waiter in a grotty trattoria near Paddington Station. It was the kind of place where you think twice about eating the breadsticks, let alone take your chances with the seafood. It didn't kill me, nor did it convert me. I ate my second in a bar in the French Quarter of New Orleans, a narrow, funereal room, cooled by an apathetic ceiling fan, neon signs fighting a losing battle against the gloom. A dive brasserie, just what I'd hoped for. With his eyes half on the muted football game, a barman in sleeve clips shoveled oysters from an ice-filled trough in the bar and shunted them croupier style towards the punters. The scene had a paradoxical exoticism of another's cultural routine. Everyone was bored except me. I raised a finger. The barman pushed an oyster my way. It was unlike any oyster I'd ever seen. A dark grey, shiny oval, monstrous as a whale's eye. It stared me down. I gave it a squirt of hot sauce and, trying to blank my mind, picked it up by its deep, craggy socket and swallowed it whole. I felt my scalp crackle, high on the oyster's dose of zinc, or the fiery sauce, or simply because I'd looked the beast in the eye and defeated it, I ordered a celebratory beer. And as it cooled my raging throat, the barman pushed something else my way, bigger, greyer, shinier, and this time there were two of them. shellfish and garlic. The richly sulfurous flavour of garlic has a multiplier effect on flavour of all shellfish, but hits a high with stewed clams. One evening on holiday, we stopped in Port Ecole on the mountainous peninsula connected to the Tuscan mainland by three dams like strands of mozzarella. After a swim in the warm sea, we drifted towards a restaurant, similarly adrift on a precariously tethered pontoon. No one else was around. The Italians would only just be digesting their lunch, but we'd driven all the way up from Rome, and the swim and the first glass of Suave had given us an appetite. We were debating how long we might be able to hold off eating when an enormous man with long, sun-ruined hair and a moustache to match sat down at our table. "Hi," he said in a slightly Americanized Italo-English accent that sounded somehow Swiss. "What would you like to eat? I'll cook you anything." This was like asking the young Hannibal if he fancied conquering any bits of the Roman Empire. I generally want everything, but we were by the sea in Italy, and it can only mean one thing, spaghetti alla vongole. In short order, we were sitting in front of golden tangled masses of garlicky pasta caught up with creamy, chewy clams, like Venus's hair before she'd had the chance to comb it through. I have a fairy godfather, and he's the chef the size of a grizzly bear who lives on a floating restaurant. Is anybody Portuguese? Okay, there's a very good... I spent the train journey on the way down trying to work out the pronunciation of a Portuguese word, which is very easy to kind of to transcribe when I came to write this, but then I thought, oh, I don't know how to say it. It looks like I'm going to get away with it. Parsley and potato. Lest old potatoes be forgot. Didn't you just love those fist-sized flowery spuds, peeled, quartered, and simmered till soft, and pale yellow with a halo of buttery fuzz? In Britain, they've all but disappeared. In Lisbon, they're everywhere, in stews, chunky soups, beside garlicky pork chops and robust sausages. Any attempt to disguise their country frumpiness other than offhand strewing of chopped parsley is mercifully resisted. Seek them out at Patio 13, one of those small family-run restaurants that materialise as casually as a cat or a line of bright washing as you explore the labyrinthine backstreets of Alfama, the oldest district of the city. Traditionally, Alfama was renowned for fado, a genre of folk music characterized by sodare, which is one of those untranslatable Iberian concepts roughly corresponding to our notions of nostalgia and loss. Sit on a parched terrace drinking tart, spritzy vino verde, watching the host turn sardines on a grill the size of a church organ. A stainless steel tray of boiled potatoes patterned with parsley provides a perfect foil for the charred, meaty fish. You can't help feeling something of a sodade for the simple boiled potato, in its prime here, but unsung everywhere else, pushed out by mash and the ubiquitous chip. Of course, many of these holiday pieces are seafood related. This is whitefish and saffron. Italians turn their nose up at the combination. According to Elizabeth David in Italian Food, they think the flavour of saffron overpowers the fish. She doesn't agree, and neither surely would anyone who's ever eaten a bouillabaisse. One evening in Antibes, a pharmacist slipped us the name of the place to get it somewhere off the coast road between Saint-Tropez and Cabazon. He didn't know the address, you just had to keep your eyes peeled. Chez Joe, as it's called, or so the pharmacist's scrawl on a rumpled napkin seemed to say, we arrived at a patch of featureless headland and climbed down a rusty ladder to a narrow beach where a dozen folding tables had been pushed into the shingle. Joe, whose shay was a cave, attended to a large pot over a large fire of driftwood, muttering to himself under a roof of dripping rock. Another man brought us a bottle of rosé from a cool box and a couple of tumblers. We drank for a while, looking out to sea, before the soup was presented along with some garlic rub bread. It tasted of the view, turbulent, seabeddy, on the vaguely sinister side of complicated. When the soup was finished, the waiter brought a fish, the fish that had been cooked in it, along with more bread and more wine. A couple of diamond-shaped almond sweetmeats called calissandets in place of a dessert, and a glass of eau de vie to make you forget where you've been and preserve the secret. More seafood. Potato and shellfish. Whole cultures have been founded on this combination. Chowder in New England, moufrite in Belgium, potato gnocchi with spider crab in Venice. At Romerio in El Porto de Santa Maria between Jerez and Cadiz, you can tuck into net fresh mariscos or pescados fritos with crisp golden chips. Romerio takes up more than its fair share of space in this lively seaside town. Two branches face each other across a perpetually crowded narrow street, one specialing in fried seafood, the other in boiled. Vast glass counters house every type of shellfish you've ever heard of, and plenty you haven't, from minicule camarones hardly bigger than the commas on the menu to lobsters meaty enough to erode themselves ashore and smacked a longshoreman in the chops for his trouble. Sea salty fried potatoes are served in paper cones printed with the restaurant's blue and white logo. Customers sit outside at Formica tables, shouting over the din as they decapitate their langostinos or peel off their delicate orange armour and toss in plastic buckets already brimming with crab claws and periwinkle shells as dark and shiny as ceremonial helmets. It's like a scene by Bruegel's more optimistic brother, Bruegel the Happier. Round the corner on Calle Misericordia, you'll find plenty of places for an aperitivo. The trick is to drink enough oaky white Rioja to order without fear from the range of bivalved and tentacular monstrosities twitching on the ice, but not so much that you arrive at Romerio when all that's left is the mound of percebes, a crustacean whose appearance can only be compared to the armour-plated trotter of a miniature aquatic pig. In English-speaking countries, percebes are also known as goose barnacles and were once believed to metamorphose into barnacle geese, an altogether more appropriate fate in my book than going anywhere near anyone's mouth. Just have the chips. And chicken and potato. In Antibes, on the Côte d'Azur, I lost my heart not to a lifeguard in a stripy swimsuit, but to a humble freestanding rotisserie. Strolling along the Rue Aubenon, I was stopped in my tracks by a bizarrely beautiful contraption of black iron and brass, like one of Jean Tanguy's creaking kinetic sculptures, except it smelt of roast chicken. Rows of birds levitated in different stages of readiness, goosebump raw to bronzed, reaching the top of their elliptical cycle before gravity turned the skewer and the birds adjusted to the downward part of their journey with a judder that shot free molten droplets of fat. The machine had a similarly hypnotic effect to the penny falls in amusement arcades, as if by pushing a raw chicken into the slot at the top, a cooked one might be displaced into the tray at the bottom. In fact, the tray at the bottom was full of crisps. Could there be anything more delicious in the world? Chicken and roast potatoes, maybe, or Portuguese-style chicken and chips. But there was something particularly irresistible about the crisp from the bottom of the rotisserie, chewy and glisteningly coated in the fat dripping from the chickens above. There's a tendency in food writing to go on at some lyrical length about the marvellous produce markets of Provence or the exquisite Umbrian trattoria that the writer and her select group of friends are the only people who've ever been to. I think this sort of writing is missing a trick. What about the Scotch egg that's guiltily wolfed down on the tube when you're very hungry, or the slightly squashed strawberry tart that redeems a truly terrible day, just as, if not, I think, more evocative. These entries dwell on meals that were memorable partly because of the unglamorousness or even unpleasantness of the circumstances. Thyme and pork. Weatherproof, thankfully. On a trip to the Dordogne, it rained all morning, most of the afternoon, and torrentially for a large part of the night. When it did let up, it was only for the clouds to accumulate fat raindrops of laughter to weep the moment anyone tiptoed towards the barbecue. Optimistically, I plan to cook garlicky pork sausages, thyme-fried onions to stuff into French bread smeared with Dijon mustard. Royally rained off, I put plan B into action. Swaddled in layers of shapeless walking clothes, I braved the cold, dank kitchen, attached the gas to the cooker, went through a box and a half of soggy matches trying to light the blasted thing. Once I had, I found a cast iron pot, cleared it of spiders, and put in some oil, the sausages, some roughly sliced onions, a jar of sinister-looking beans. From the overgrown garden, I plucked a sprig of thyme, vivid green from its soaking, and threw it in the pot with salt and pepper and a long slug of wine. Putting it in the oven with a prayer to the presiding spirit of butane, I went to sit by the fire that my husband had made. From a stack of tatty paperbacks about idealistic English people making an ultimately rewarding hash of moving to France or Tuscany, called things like stumbling on artichokes or nothing to lose. I peeled off a few layers of Gore-Tex and fleece. Gradually, the smell of pork, thyme and garlic displaced the fungal reek of a long, empty holiday home. Beans have an amplifying effect on the aroma and flavours of food. It started to feel just a little bit homely. Of course, you'd be completely glorifying my dish to call it cassoulet, but then you'd be completely glorifying my 5 days in France to call it a holiday. That makes it sound much more fun than it was. Globe artichoke and bacon. In Lazio, a boyfriend and I were speeding through a landscape of fairy tale castles, well on our way to not living happily ever after. We had been arguing with such uninterrupted intensity that it was only a promising road sign that reminded us that it was well past lunchtime and we were hungry. Our motherly Italian hostess, perhaps picking up on the friction between us, took pity and led us to a table under an olive tree. Mercifully soon, she brought a labelless bottle of cold, dry white wine, an enormous spoon, and a terracotta dish of something covered in breadcrumbs and cheese, molten bubbles popping on the surface like the meniscus of a volcano. My boyfriend, or ex-boyfriend, or whatever he was at that moment, took the spoon and, breaking through the crust, emerged with a steaming heap of rigatoni, pancetta and artichokes in a rich bechamel, savoury, sweet with parmesan. They say hunger is the best sauce, but if that lunch under the olive tree is anything to go by, the point in a relationship where it doesn't matter anymore runs at a close second. We smiled at each other, I topped up our glasses, he piled the pasta on our plates. The bitter, nutty greenness of the artichoke cut through the richness of pancetta and cheese. It was by far the best last date I've ever had. soft cheese and bell pepper. In Corsica, it's difficult to eat a meal without the local cheese, brochu, a ricotta-like sheep's cheese, sometimes with a bit of goat's milk mixed in. Brochu is served with fruit and jam for breakfast, with charcuterie for lunch, and in cannelloni for dinner. You'll see the sheep and goats it comes from hanging around on the hairpin bends of Corsica's heart-stopping coastal road system. They'll probably be the last things you see. We stopped in Calvi to buy a beach picnic for a walk along the coast. We'd stocked up on charcuterie, bread and tomatoes when the shop owner insisted we also try some miniature bell peppers stuffed with brochu. A couple of hours later, we were clambering over rocks in desperate search of a lunch spot. As we unpacked the picnic, we were joined first by one wasp, then another, and then nine more, until our alfresco paradise began to look like the set of a B-movie. As I lifted a stuffed pepper to my lips, a wasp heli-skied into the cheese, and in my flustered hand movement, shooing it away, I launched a piece of prosciutto onto a rock. One wasp chased after it, and then another, quickly followed by the others. And, ingenious by accident, we got on with our picnic in peace. Which begs the question, do wasps particularly like prosciutto, or are they just sick to the mandibles of brochu? I'd come round to it myself. Its sweet milkiness at once complemented and offset the sweet smokiness of the peppers. Potato and egg. The simplest, cheapest proof that you needn't be an oligarch to eat like a king. A fleshy, fluffy chip dipped into a deep, runny yolk, or a fried egg on a pillow of potato puree. Add a little onion and you have all you need for a Spanish tortilla, sweet, cakey omelette, soft, earthy potato, bittersweet, caramelised onion. Eat one fresh from the pan, yellow as a euro on the mid-afternoon pavement, or the next day, by which time it will have taken on a deeper, more savoury flavour, plus a greyish tinge that won't matter the slightest if you slip it into a crusty white roll for an eggier take on the chip butty. A bit rustic, perhaps, but nothing on the huevos con patatas we ate one evening late in Spain. We ordered it thinking it would be a tortilla or a brick pandering egg and chips. What arrived was a dainty saucer piled with plain potato crisps that had been knocked around the pan with a couple of eggs. Not quite scrambled, not quite fried. Self-respecting two-year-old would have binned it and started again. But it was gone midnight and there was nowhere else open, and once the chewy slices of potato, bound into clusters by the sort of buttery, lacy egg, had proved definitively resistant to division by fork, we rolled back our sleeves and ate with our fingers. It was great. We finished it down to the last scrap, etching our wine glasses with greasy fingerprints. The next few entries refer to combinations that are mentioned in other books. So I remember reading The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath, and my college classmates were empathising with Esther Greenwood's existential pain. I kept rereading the passage where she describes the combination of chicken and caviar. In Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, Esther Greenwood attends a smart luncheon where she hatches a plan to monopolise an entire bowl of caviar. If, she observes, you carry yourself with a certain arrogance when you do something incorrect at the table, people will think you're original rather than bad-mannered. She says, under cover of the clinking of water goblets and silverware and bone china, I paved my plate with chicken slices. Then I covered the chicken slices with caviar, thickly as if I was spreading peanut butter on a piece of bread. Then I picked up the chicken slices in my fingers one by one, rolled them so the caviar wouldn't ooze off, and ate them. Beef and liver. Less fancy versions of beef Wellington prevail, but the real deal is fillet steak slathered in pâté de foie gras and shavings of fresh truffle, then wrapped in puff pastry. Putting it together is simple, cooking it less so. Left in the oven for too long, the meat starts to steam and shrink. Lose your nerve and take it out too soon and you'll have soggy pastry and undercooked beef. Exactly what happens to Doris Shelt in Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift when she makes beef Wellington for her boyfriend Charlie Citrine. Charlie's next girlfriend Renata plays it safe and sticks to serving champagne cocktails while wearing feathers and a G-string. Worth bearing in mind if you're having an off day in the kitchen. Chicken and rose. Chicken served with rose petals or rose water was popular in Mughal, Moorish and medieval English kitchens. In Laura Esquivel's novel, Like Water for Chocolate, the heroine Tita brings her sister Gertrudis to an orgasmic boiling point with a dish made from rose petals and quail. Riat Savarin would not have approved. In his opinion, the flavour of quail is the most exquisite and the most fugitive of all game, and therefore to serve it any other way than plainly roasted or en piat was nothing short of barbaric. If you subscribe to this view, you might find that chicken is an acceptable substitute for quail in dishes that call for sauce. Many cooks do. The psychologists Hollingworth and Poffenberger claim that with tactual qualities removed, most people fail to distinguish between the flavours of chicken, turkey and quail. But tactual qualities are not to be sniffed at. Would Gertrudis have such a good time chomping through a skinless chicken breast as gnawing on a sticky little quail's leg? And this is not from a fiction book, but it's stranger than fiction. Orange and Olive. La Cucina Futurista was published in 1932 by the poet Marinetti after he'd spent a few years travelling around Europe organising banquets that featured wild flavour pairings and recipes with titles like Excited Pig, Elasticake, Steel Chicken and Piquant Airport. My favourite's called Aerofood. While the sound of an aeroplane motor and Something Suitable by Bach plays loudly from the kitchen, the diner is served, from the right, a plate of kumquats, black olives and fennel. Rectangles of silk, sandpaper and velvet are served from the left and the diner must eat with the right hand while simultaneously stroking these with the left. Meanwhile, the waiter spritzes the nape of the diner's neck with a carnation perfume. Carnations have a rose clove fragrance. Try Santa Maria Novella's Garofano. The plane might prove trickier to source. So before I got started on the Flavothesaurus, I talked to my husband, who's also a writer, about the prospect of describing hundreds of combinations and whether he thought I'd start to flag after the first 100 or so. And his advice to me stuck throughout the sort of 3 years that I was writing the book. And he said, I should think of the pairings as a parade of couples, that I should sit back, relax, have a glass of wine, and think of myself commenting on them as if you were the passaggiata in an Italian city. Clearly, sitting back and relaxing with a glass of wine is fundamentally incompatible with the process of actually writing anything. So, but it was a useful image to keep in mind, and certainly some of these combinations, I think I'd started to get into the anthropomorphizing of my ingredients. So black pudding and shellfish is a modern classic. In fancy restaurants, pale scallop is often found perched trembling like an ingenue on filthy old black pudding's knee. And chicken and avocado, good together if a little blandly healthy, like those smug couples you see running together in the park. Give chicken a smoke and things could start to look up. Aubergine and garlic were all either radiators or drains. Radiators are the outgoing, effusive, participatory. Drains suck the energy out of the room. Couples often comprise of one of each. Your eagerness to see X, the radiator, is tempered by your dread of being stuck next to Y, the drain. In this partnership, garlic is the radiator. It's a beguiling extrovert. Aubergine is the drain, unpredictable, often bitter, and needing a lot of attention or an unhealthy amount of lubrication to cajole it into a companionable mood. Together they make baba ganoush, mix the flesh of roasted or grilled aubergines with raw garlic, tahini, olive oil, lemon juice, and parsley. I always worry when I read that. I think, oh yeah, I think I know that my husband is the radiator. And people eye me in a funny way. Okay. Sometimes it's not just types, but sometimes it's specific people doing specific things. So avocado and lime. Lee Hazelwood and Nancy Sinatra singing Some Velvet Morning. Lee, the velvety baritone note of avocado. Nancy, the high-pitched lime that cuts through the smoothness just when you're getting too comfortable. At once beautiful together and distinctly separate. The association may be largely down to my having played the song over and over again during a drive down Highway 1 in California on my honeymoon, while others toast their future together over lightly grilled fish and flutes of champagne served on lapping pontoon in the Indian Ocean. We stopped at strip-lit taquerias and ate burritos the size of a shot putter's forearms. Tender strips of grilled steak come rolled in floury, slightly crisp tortilla packed with rice, beans, sour cream, mouth-watering, lime-laced guacamole and salsa so fiery you have to grip the sides of the little plastic serving basket till your eyes stop streaming tears. On the subject of guacamole, some say that leaving the avocado stone in will prevent it from discoloration. My view is that if the guacamole is around long enough to find out, you're not making it right. Also started to get a little bit defensive about some of the established relationships versus some of the new relationships and starting to interfere like a worried friend. Coriander leaf and tomato, dancing partners in a salsa, so popular that sales of prepared salsa have overtaken ketchup in North America. Basil needs to watch its back. Somewhere in the warehouse district in Minneapolis, a short gust of freezing wind from the Mississippi stands the Monte Carlo, a supper club dating from 1906, when the lumber trade was at its height. The place isn't retro, you're just late. It has a tin ceiling and a copper bar and serves the kind of martinis to make you see the prohibitionist's point. Once your eyes have uncrossed, you'll find yourself with the appetite of a timber baron, easily satisfied with one of the Monte Carlo's trademark flatbread pizzas, topped with tomato, Havarti cheese, and coriander pesto. Every time I ate one, I thought, they should make more pizzas with coriander, and that, Basil, is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a pizza. Of course, there are, as I say, 982 entries in the Flavor Thesaurus, and I have been reading a certain type of them, but actually some of them are about food. And what you have on your plate left, hopefully, is one little last tasting to go with this entry. Goat's cheese and apricot. A great stand-up kitchen snack. Stuff a plump dried apricot with a modestly pungent goat's cheese and note just how meaty the combination is. The sweet perfume fruitiness of apricot emphasizes savouriness of the cheese and the whole somehow recalls lamb. Goat's cheese, in common with cooked lamb and mutton, contains caprylic acid, which accounts for the similarity in flavour. So if you're used to eating lamb, if you have a tagine or if you have a stuffed lamb with apricot, when you try it with the goat's cheese, the brain might be trying to think, well, what does this remind me of? And sometimes it really tastes like lamb to some people. It depends on how the caprylic acid is something that you're either very, very sensitive to or not. If you do the same thing, goat's cheese with mint, you'll have the same kind of lambiness because the brain is also often very used to connecting lamb and mint together. shellfish and beef. The term surf and turf is thought to have originated in the USA in the 1960s, although its catchiness and the cachet conferred by the payday price ticket are probably more responsible for its enduring popularity than any particular flavour affinity between lobster and beef. They're fine. Beef flavour tends to be intensified by marine partners such as anchovy and olive, but I find the combination of lean, dense flesh can add up to a chewy chore. And I'm not convinced that beef does much for the lobster in return. The basic idea, of course, has been reinterpreted by various chefs as scallops with foie gras, octopus with bone marrow, monkfish tail with oxtail. And in the late 80s, the term was applied by my Hungry ML colleagues to the blowout combination of a Big Mac and a filet of fish. Alligator meat, incidentally, is said to taste like a hybrid of shellfish and veal. Apple and hard cheese. Glorious. A friend of mine once told me rather sniffily that the ploughman's lunch was a marketing convention. But I'm hardly going to turn my back on old, centuries-old combination of cheese and apple and bread simply because somebody gave it a slightly naff name. A wedge of tangy mature cheddar or Stilton, like a road sign warning of a steep hill ahead, with a whole apple, half a loaf of crumbly brown bread, and some homemade pickles and chutneys. The sharpness of the cheese cuts through the salty creaminess of the sharpness of the apple cuts through the salty creaminess of the cheese, making it just the thing with good beer or cider. You could also try a sharp, hard cheese with apple pie, as is the custom in Yorkshire and parts of America. Some take the cheese on the side, others bake it underneath the pastry crust. In Wisconsin, a law was once passed banning the consumption of apple pie without cheese. Eugene Field, 1850 to 1895, wrote a poem to the pairing, and in Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle orders apple pie with melted cheese in a coffee shop, some say in reference to a similar request made by psychopath Ed Gein in exchange for a full confession. Ed Gein was the really terrible man who was the model for the character of Norman Bates and who was the Buffalo Bill in the Silence of the Lambs. Not very appetizing, I guess. Potato and lamb should get a room. They're all over each other. Stoic beef keeps its distance, even squeezed up close to potato in cottage pie. The fattiness of lamb, on the other hand, seeps into potato in shepherd's pie, thick, spicy Indian goshaloo, or Lancashire's famous hot pot. John Thornton, the mill owner in Elizabeth Gaskell's North and South, is surely in contention for one of the earliest bourgeois enthusiasts of peasant food. Of the hot pot he eats with his workers, he says, "I have never made a better dinner in my life." Years later, conceivably in homage to Mrs. Gaskell, factory boss Mike Baldwin raves over Betty's hot pot in Coronation Street. The real secret of a great hot pot is not the use of tasty neck-end lamb or mutton, or browning the meat in dripping, or lots of layers of meat, onion, potato, or even adding a few kidneys under the final roof of sliced potatoes. It is time, the one thing the bustling industrialist lacks. I was thinking that I would add a fourth thing to the tasting plate. I wanted to put a peanut butter and blackcurrant jam sandwich, or at least part of one, onto the plate, but I just had a slight school memory of what peanut butter sandwiches are like when they've been made in the morning and been kind of carted around in Tupperware for about 4 hours, and I thought I might spare you. Blackcurrant and peanut. I was expecting a degree of culture shock when I went to live in America, but what really caught me off guard were the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. Not per se, but because they were made with grape and sometimes strawberry jam. Who were they kidding, not using blackcurrant? And who was I, a limey, to complain? Schmuckers, manufacturers of America's market-leading Jif peanut butter, claim the PB&J dates from the Second World War, when GIs were supplied with both products in their rations. In the absence of actual butter, you can see how the peanut variety caught on. After the war, the popularity of the sandwich skyrocketed, but without wanting to turn my nose up at anything almost American as apple pie, I couldn't see how sweet raspberry or grape could have been thought as a better partner for fatty, salty peanut butter than the sharp, complex blackcurrant. I didn't know that blackcurrants were, in fact, rarely eaten in the States. At the turn of the 20th century, it was discovered that the blackcurrant plant, Rebus nigrum, was a vector for a disease that affected the white pine tree, which was vital to booming construction industry. growing black currants became a crime under federal law. And although the enforcement of the ban has since been shifted to state jurisdiction, only a few states have lifted it. So the flavour is much less familiar to the US than the European palate. Where our purple sweets are almost always blackcurrant flavour, American purple candies are grape, specifically Concord grape, derived from a species native to North America. Although blackcurrant and Concord grape are easily distinguishable as flavours, both share a catty quality in common with Sauvignon Blanc, gooseberries and green tea. And finally, I hope this has just got you to the point where it's 1 o'clock and you'll be getting ready for lunch. I hope this doesn't put you off. Cabbage and onion. Cabbage or sprouts and onion add flavour to cooked potatoes in Bubble and Squeak, the UK's favourite leftover dish. In the 19th century, Bubble and Squeak was a fried combination of leftover beef and cabbage, but the dish is now invariably meatless. I love it so much that I often cook more vegetables than we can possibly eat with the roast chicken on Sunday. Whether premeditated surplus actually counts as leftovers is, however, a taxing philosophical problem. Processed food companies now sell ready-prepared Bubble and Squeak, i.e. leftovers, with no main meal from which they've been left over, which raises a number of dizzying questions. Can, for example, leftovers, left over from nothing, actually be said to exist? And what do you call them if you have any left over? I hope that's whetted your appetite. Thank you for coming. And if anybody would like to ask me any questions, then I'd be very happy to try and answer them.
Thank you very much, Nikki. I'm sure none of us have ever been to a reading before to which we've had such a sensory reaction. It was both pure pleasure and sheer torture, having our appetites whetted by your wonderful and very personal way of describing food combinations and food pairings. What I did want to ask you is, and you hinted a little bit at it there with the reading from Surf and Turf, are there any combinations or pairings in common currency which you think are downright awful or repugnant? And so can you say anything to counter the effect of inflaming all our appetites, which you've just done?
Well, yes and no. I think, for me, one of the flavour combinations, I mean, of course, the book is everyone's flavour thesaurus would be different to some degree because the way that we experience flavours is different. But the one that I don't understand, which is a British classic for no good reason that I can see, is rhubarb and ginger. Which, when I think about it, you have this incredibly, you know, the very of sourness of rhubarb and then the bitter, slight dustiness of ginger. And whenever I think of them together, I think of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. And it seems to me like two kind of quite diva-ish ingredients that don't particularly like each other very much and have a kind of hot unfriendliness. But Delia likes it, so who am I to disagree?
I think the, if I'm not mistaken, the French have a hangover cure called a port flip, which is a raw egg yolk and port. I've never tried that. Do you think that would be nice?
I think what you need to do is try and get yourself a hangover first, and that I can really help you with. Actually, if you think when you think about it, actually, there are so many egg yolk based. Drinks, and if you go back into history, of course, the eggnog was pretty much made with everything, every kind of alcohol and an egg. I think the egg was almost neutral. The only thing I would say is the first time that I made eggnog, I forgot to strain it, and that makes for an extremely unpleasant textural experience.
I really love your book, and it's very comprehensive, and yet I'm sure that when you were writing it, there were things that you had to discard along the way, and you have 99 flavours and then sort of pair them up with other ones. And so are there combinations or particular flavours that you had to leave out that you sort of regret?
I don't think there are combinations. When I started this, I had 160 flavours that I was working on, and then actually it became ridiculous to try and write chapters about sprouts and cabbage. You know, and you could just kind of start putting them together. There was a little bit of an issue about whether we had a black pudding chapter, because that is probably the only thing in the book that is itself a combination. It's not really necessarily a pure ingredient. Did I miss anything? I left out courgettes, and in fact, I left out courgettes because every time I came to write the chapter, I just thought, butter, fat, lard, cheese, more butter, more fat. You know, fry. You know, And so in the front, it says, look, I've left out courgettes. Apologies to any courgette fans. And actually, there really are courgette fans, I found out. And people are saying, how could you have left it out? It's so great. There are loads that I would like to add to the book, but I can't remember leaving anything. I think I just sort of was quite willful and put in things that I really love. So, you know, chapters on foie gras, for example. That was quite... putting foie gras into the chapter, sneaking it in onto the liver so that I wouldn't get told off. I'm trying to think. There's 99 ingredients, and I think probably 7 or 8 are meat. So about 7 or 8 are meat. So yes, there's lots in there. I think there's also some things in there. Are you a vegetarian for moral reasons or because you don't like, meat?
Moral reasons.
Okay. Well, I think then what some of the things that I found very interesting are. I don't know how you found the goat's cheese and apricot, and whether that had quite a pleasant flavour for you because you remember eating lamb and liking it but not wanting to eat it. But there's quite a few things like that in the book about there's a blue cheese made of buffalo milk in Yorkshire, and when I tried it I thought, my goodness, this tastes like the fat from a mature rump steak. And there's lots and lots of different French cheeses where the French feel that they might taste like veal and that kind of thing. So I think if you're a vegetarian for moral reasons and you miss meat, there's lots of kind of interesting things about ingredients that might taste like bacon or bring the same kind of quality. So it's a bit of sort of substitution information in there in particular that might be interesting to you. But then, as I say, there's probably 92 flavours that are veggie-friendly.
Hello. Given your obvious delight in the combinations and wonderful flavours, do you then sort of despair of people who smother their food in ketchup and brown sauce, or do they have their own redeeming features?
I think they have. Well, I don't know if you can tell much from the reading. I really don't have a very snobby approach to food because I find it very hard to imagine that people really don't love quite a lot of the things that they used to like when they were a child. And we love them for all sorts of ingrained emotional reasons. So while I might be annoyed if somebody added quite a lot of ketchup to something I'd spent time cooking, I certainly wouldn't normally, I think people should just sort of eat things how they like them, really. It's a shame, though. I mean, it does kind of, they do... they are so strong, they do kind of knock your taste buds to six a bit. They will make everything else taste a bit bland, don't they? There is a pie in the book, actually, that's made with tinned corned beef, and my editor thought it was disgusting and shouldn't include it, but, I liked it, I want to put it in.
I just wanted to ask, that book obviously represents the culmination of a long-standing passion for you, and it's been fantastically successful. What are your other passions? What's going to come next?
Well, there's the swearing thesaurus, apparently. I've been told that I might be quite good at writing that. And then I was also conscious, I really, really struggled not to be a smoker, so I was interested in the idea of writing a book about what to smoke with what you drink and whether a camel is better with a certain drink or not. But and I think anything else that I like, I probably wouldn't be able to write a book about. I don't think anyone wants to write, I would like to probably be the next Pullen Thompson sister and write books about ponies. but I'm not sure there's a market for that anymore. I'm probably safer sticking with food. Yeah.
I think probably the next book, you've put us off the scent, but probably the next book is going to be the Thesaurus of Courgettes, and that's going to be there. We have to bring the event to an end there, but I just want to thank on behalf of everyone here, Nikki, for the most wonderful talk. I don't think any of us can remember coming to the end of a Small Wonder event feeling quite so hungry, and I can imagine the car park people are going to be racing off site to get to fish and chip shops and Waitrose if it's still open on Sunday and Lewis, and I think what came across in your readings and the talk is just how well written and how beautifully imaginative this book is. I mean, I just jotted down as we were going through, you know, chicken and avocado as the smug couple jogging together. It's just a great image, and the you know, Bruegel the happier, and Basil needs to watch its back. Potato and lamb should get a room. I mean, they're just, well, I think you've all got the idea that this is a fantastic book, indispensable, and I know that you'll all want a signed copy after this, but please join me in thanking Nikki for the really most wonderful event. Thank you very much. I should just say we're going to take Nikki to the bookstall at the back and to get her a drink if she wants one. There was a slight kind of reference to alcohol in there somewhere. I just intuited perhaps. And then do come and join us. Thank you.
It's Sunday lunchtime.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. No.
After 12 o'clock, it's fine.
12? Oh, you're harsh down here.